I'm Brandon Webb, former Navy SEAL and founder of Crate Club, the number one tactical and survival gear subscription box in America. Being prepared matters, so choose military-grade, hand-picked gear by special ops professionals. Gift Crate Club today at crateclub.com.
Force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Fans, and welcome to another episode of SoftRep Radio. My name is Stavros Atlamazoglou, and I'm SoftRep's Managing Editor. I will be hosting this week's episode alongside our very own George Hunt, Delta Force pipe hitter and SoftRep writer. Our guest today is Greg Cocker, veteran of the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, also known as the Night Stalkers, and all-around badass. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here with you guys.
Could you please give us a brief background of your service?
Yes, sir. I enlisted in the Army, and I was an infantryman assigned to the 101st. I always wanted to fly helicopters since I was a little kid. My dad was in the Air Force, so I was always hanging around flight operations and airfields. And at the time, I didn't have a degree, and the only vehicle for me was to go to the Army in their warrant officer program. I just put in my paperwork after about 3 years, got selected, went to Fort Rucker. My first assignment out of Rucker was flying AH-1 Cobras in South Korea. That was for a year. And then I came back to the States, transitioned to Apaches, AH-64s. Yeah, I've been a gun guy my whole life, so I just like shooting stuff and blowing shit up. And I remember when I was a young soldier there at Campbell, sitting in back one day, and we'd just come out of the field. We were cleaning weapons and getting our gear all ready, and these four little black helicopters flew over, and I was looking at them, and my platoon sergeant, you know, he kind of screamed at me and told me to get back to work and stop looking at those helicopters. They didn't exist.
Good stuff.
And I was like, oh, really? Okay. I don't know. Several months later, it was pretty funny. I told him I was going to go fly those little black helicopters, and he told me I was stupid. So,
oh, no.
I wish I could find that guy today. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, that would be great if you could do that. You know, rubbing his face, you know?
Yeah, he's probably retired sergeant major somewhere. I knew about the unit, of course, being at Fort Campbell. And actually, I had some very close friends that were in B Company, 1st and 160th. So they were they flew the gunships. So I aspired. I just worked hard as an aviator and as a gun guy. And I wanted to be with the best. And everybody said they were the best. So I assessed and I put in my packet as a young W-2. I was told later that I didn't meet the standards for the regiment at the time. This was in 93, but you had to have 1,000 hours of flight time and 100 hours of night vision goggles. Well, I'd flown a lot of MVG in Korea and then, of course, at Campbell in the Apache unit under Commander Cody, later to be General Cody. So I had over, I think, like 260 hours of night vision goggles. And I had about almost just over 600 hours of flight time, but they weighed that out and they said, yeah, let's assess this guy and see how he does. So that's what I did. Did my assessment and came back to B Company first 160 to fly the AH-6s for almost 15 years.
Nice. Very interesting. Gio?
So, since we're on the topic of the gunships, you know, I know you flew AH-6J model. I imagine I'm aware of all the different gun configurations that you can put on an AH-6 or on a gunbird. Do you have a particular configuration that you like to fly, and are you in control of what configuration you get before you fly a mission? Or is that like a kind of a top-down decision?
Well, that's a good question, George. The mission depends on the threat. So we can configure Roger. The aircraft. So if we have, you know, a light armor threat or heavy defense, then I can hang a Gal 19, that's a 3-barrel 50 cal, on it. We call it trips. So we go with a Gal, minigun, and a rocket pod, or we can hang it with heavy hellfire. But my favorite is the dual minis and dual rocket pods. So it's probably the most violent thing on Earth.
Yeah, I agree with you. I almost asked that question when we were talking on the phone the other day, but I deemed it too stupid to ask at the time, and now I just heard the answer. So it is true that an AH-6 can take a Hellfire configuration.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. So do you get one on each side, or how many rockets can you get?
We can carry four missiles, two on each.
Four missiles.
Yeah, generally we'll go with a missile side and then a minigun.
It's cool as hell, man. I didn't know that. You mentioned that, and this is another thing I had no idea of, but you mentioned an AH-6 can really engage in no appreciable amount of time hovering anywhere just because of the sheer weight of the gun package, right?
That's correct.
In all my days, I was thinking that, wow, you know, if I get in a real fix during this mission, an AH-6 can swoop down and pick me up. And that's probably not the case ever.
No, we
realized that at the time.
Well, I've actually done that. Yeah, I mean, we can land, but we can't, you know, we can't hang around and at a hover because of the weight. Now we can, you know, I can come in and land just about anywhere. To hover, we get into the limits of the engine, and you know,
yeah.
It depends on the environmentals and things like that. But I know for a fact there was a case, one of the Delta guys who got shot one night in Baghdad, and an AH landed on the roof. They calculated that it would be faster to fly him to the cache. The plan was to get him off the building and into a pander and get him on one of the armored vehicles, and it was going to take over 20 minutes. And I said, no, let's just fly him there. So gunbird landed. They kicked out the ammo cans and threw Billy in the dock on and got him there in about 6 minutes.
That's great. That pretty much wraps up my questions on the gun configuration. I'm glad I asked, honestly.
Oh, there's been all kind of other stories and other combat operations and training where we'll actually practice it. You know, we'll land and we'll pull the cans out or to reduce weight or rockets or whatever. So we could get a couple guys. We can get one guy on each side. So they just John Wayne the minigun. You know, they'll sit on the plank and then straddle the minigun. It's funny because they always ask us, please don't fire that gun while I'm.
No, I would ask you to fire it. And definitely fire the gun and get a picture as well, you know.
Oh, gosh.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, it would be a bad day if we had to fire the gun
with
a dude sitting on the plank.
So, Craig, did you pick the little bird as your platform, or does the regiment assign new pilots according to its needs?
That's a great question, and I had requested a gun company, so B Company, and one, again, I had several good friends there, and just, you know, it was my natural progression as a gun guy, because if you bring a fella in that flew Blackhawks or, you know, any other aircraft, you got to teach him to shoot, and at least, you know, at that point in a gun guy's career, he understands ballistics and weapon systems and, you know, putting the sight on the target and accurately engaging it. So there are some gun guys that went, or 58 guys that went to ACO, you know, because it's still it's an MH-6. It's that smaller aircraft.
And, yeah.
But most of the time it's the needs of the regiment. In my case, I told them I'd go fly hot air balloons if that's what they wanted. So,
yeah, never turn down anything but your collar. Yeah.
Yes, sir. Yeah. I guess I'm, you know, not that smart, so they sent me to B Company.
Hey, but Chief, what about the DAP? Did you ever have any experience flying the DAP frame?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I got to go up with those guys, and it's a great platform, and that thing can carry some armament, and, you know, good guys, we lovingly refer to them as skirts.
Skirts?
Yeah, it's still a Black Hawk, and there's just a lot of, you know, just like any unit, we all pick on each other and hack on each other, but like the MH6 Little Bird guys, we'd always tell them they all wear thong panties, and then the Black Hawk guys would wear, they wear skirts.
That's just rude, man.
Yeah.
Hey, Chief, we got to ribbon with some age pilots from the Stalkers, and when we wanted to irritate it, we would refer to the bird as a tiny bird.
Oh,
and that God, got under yeah. their skin really quick.
Yeah.
It's the little things, man.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I mean, I had no idea. My first experience with a DAP was in Somalia. It was outside the city, just, you know, gunning some targets one night. AHs were making runs, and it was the typical, you know, two pots, 2 6 guns.
Yeah.
It's the same thing over and over, you know, brr, whoosh, whoosh. And yes, we made, sir. I don't know, 15 or some sorties over a knocked out ZSU-4 Soviet anti-aircraft chassis. Then suddenly, the 16th run was a freaking DAP, and I had never heard of or seen a DAP before.
Oh,
it came over, man, and it started cranking out a 30 millimeter chain gun.
Yeah.
Then it sent a salvo of rockets, and I was filming it with a camcorder at the time.
Wow.
And the sight is amazing, but the background noise is right after it launches the rocket, you could hear me go, "What the fuck was that?"
Where'd that tank come from?
It's great, man. Scared.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's another tool in the toolbox that
yeah, the respect,
customer
man.
Has and that we can provide for them. So, yeah, it's a pretty dynamic team.
Roger, and wicked range, too, on the DAP, right?
Oh, yeah, man. It's got long, long legs. So, of course, you know, everybody knows it can aerial refuel. And, of course, they were part of the package that on the invasion in Afghanistan in 01, they escorted the Chinooks in for over 1,000 miles.
Wow. 1,000 miles. Okay.
Yes, sir. As long as air assault in history.
Yeah, I would say so. 1,000 miles. Is that 1,000 miles without a refuel, or is that?
They aerial refueled.
Speaking of the invasion of Afghanistan, would you mind telling us a bit about your halo, almost halo, with the Rangers?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that was, I mean, we were just doggone. It was so exciting, and it was a lot of fun. And, of course, there was a lot of chaos in the early days because, you know, we were all trying to figure out what to do. And I never will forget. I think it was either Gerald Daly or it was Lieutenant Colonel Blaber. They put out one of our
Blaber, Ross.
Yeah,
awesome.
Pete and Scotty Miller was there. Me and Scotty used to sit outside the tent every night when I'd get back, and we just talk, or I'd chat with Colonel Schwitter. And Colonel Schwitter was a really interesting fella.
Flatliner? Yeah, the guys call him Flatliner.
Flatliner, yes. I never call him that, but
and just had a real deadpan expression, and you know, but he's damn good. Twitter's superior.
Yeah, carpet. I know. And I was told, I don't know, Gio, you may confirm this, but I was told that he was on Desert One as an E6 in Iran, and after the crash and all that chaos, that Colonel Beckwith had made him. He was the last. Last soldier to get a battlefield commission. Beckwith made him a lieutenant right there on the spot because he didn't have any other.
I'll tell you what, man. I do know for a fact that Jim Schwitter's was a battlefield commission. Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, then that's a true deal then. Wow. That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Back to my original thought was that I think it was General Daly. He was a TF sword commander and or it was Colonel Blaber, because he was, well, you know, Pete, he's a wild man. Anyway, they put a box out in front of our briefing area, and it said battle suggestions. So and what they put out,
No, that's desperate.
And this is typical. American Army goes to war, and we practice chaos daily. But they're like, any idea you can think of, you put it in this box. And I mean, some of this stuff, it was pretty cool. Some of it we actually used. And
Shit, bro.
Yeah, it worked. But we were getting ready. We were in the planning process, and it was, you know, my good friend, Master Sergeant Leon Hansen, he was the fire support NCO for B Squatter. Yeah, Leon. So he was back and forth from the ship, and I was back and forth from the ship. I was on Masur Island. I was a TF fire support officer. So we were getting the plan together, and one day we were looking at some photos of Objective Rhino. Rhino was like a hunting camp, or I don't remember exactly what they called it. I'm like, what in the world are they hunting out here in the desert of Afghanistan?
Chief, Objective Rhino, that was a ranger mission, correct?
Yes. And actually, there's footage of the ranger jumping.
Yeah, there's video and photos. And yeah, it was quite a historic event. But so we were talking about landing C-130s there for FARP. And because the ski maneuver, I'll just put it in a snapshot, was that we were going into Gecko. Objective Gecko was Omar's place of residence, just west of Kandahar. And then our FART was an airfield. It was a runway landing strip out in the middle of nowhere. Of course, outbuildings and housing and things like that. And that's where we were going to land the C-130s for FART when they came off of Objective Gecko for the helicopters.
Roger.
So we were looking at it, and actually, I think it was myself, Colonel Schwitter, Leon, and Scotty Miller, and we were talking about landing on this runway. Well, in one of the pictures, there was a Boeing 707 parked on the ramp.
Four engines.
Yeah. Big airplane. So evidently some sheik or somebody flew in there to, you know, hunt. And then they got to talking about they wanted to put a Ranger reconnaissance team in there. Which made sense. I think Colonel Blaber, he was the biggest proponent. Well, they had asked for a fire supporter to go with them. So Pete was like, well, take Gravy. You know, he's the TF guy. Leon's on the ship. You know, we can't put him in there and then get him back and that back out to the ship. But so the commander approached me from the Rangers and says, hey, Greg, you're going to be like, you know, we're requesting that you go on this jump with us. And I was pretty excited, man. And one thing led to another, and we were in there briefing the plan, and this Air Force colonel jumps up, and he says, no, we got to put a CCT guy in there, you know, combat control. They know how to perk the airfields and da-da-da. And I'm like, sir, look at this picture. There's a Boeing 707 that landed. And he's parked, and in this picture, it's gone. So I know a C-130 can land there.
Check it out, man.
Yeah. I was trying to keep my place on the team instead of the combat control guy. And my good buddy, Jim Hosey, we were in B Company together. He was an AH pilot. You may remember Jimbo, but he told me, he's like, dude, you're going to find yourself in the middle of all this stuff. Because I wasn't real happy about being the fire support officer, because I'm an AH guy, man. And I've been training for 15 years. And, you know, and everybody was pissed off anyway at these dudes. So we wanted to go out there and get some and kill some of these dudes. But it all worked out. You know, I still flew AH missions, but I got to be on the pointy end of the spear, so to speak, and wrecking the routes for the helicopters. And I mean, we started going in there late September, early October. I had a gunship assigned to me, an AC-130U model. And we were setting the conditions, prepping the battlefield, or gaining intelligence. We'd go out full every night and come back empty every morning. I mean, we were killing some stuff, man. It was a lot of fun. But anyway, so I got bunked off the jump because I guess this colonel was, you know, he was pretty upset that Air Force Special Operations wasn't going to get in a fight. And I said, okay, you know, no big deal. But it was funny because Pete Blaber took me into one of the buildings there, and I says, hey, I'm not HALO qualified, you know? And he goes, don't worry, man, I got to shoot for you. So we went in there, and he gave me some training. And yeah, I was very surprised. General Daly was like, and I've known General Daly for many years, and he's like, you know, Greg can do it, no worries. So they took off the Ranger Recon team and the CCT guy, and they were about a minute from jump. Well, the Air Force guy indeed shoot inside the aircraft. So, hey, George, I'm sure you've seen a discharge of a chute in an aircraft, but you ain't going anywhere, and everybody's scrambling to get the chute in so it doesn't suck you out the back end of the airplane.
Twice I've been experienced that.
Oh, my gosh, man.
It's scary shit is what it
yeah.
is.
Yeah, it is. But the guys got word of it. And I saw the plane when it came back. And that Air Force dude was walking off with a chute all bundled up in his arms, you know.
Oh, man.
He was all poopy faced. But
karma, bro, has no shelf life.
I don't know, man, because I met those guys when they came back, and I said, okay, you sons of guns, what happened? They're like, we don't know what happened. All we know is he didn't jump. I was like, wink, wink, you know? Hey. I think somebody might have reached over and grabbed that red ball.
I don't know. I got to ask you, in all seriousness, and it's important because I just wrote an essay, and Stavros has got it right now in editing, and I made remarks regarding static line and HALO, you know, operations. But are you serious that, I mean, I know Pete Blaber is serious, but were you seriously going to do a HALO jump?
Yeah, I was going to go with him.
That is one badass thing to do, man. My hat is off.
Everything. At that point, it was an urgency, man. I mean, we had the ground. And we had no intel whatsoever because the prior administration had pulled everyone out of that part of the world. They'd cut all the money. We had to start from scratch all over again. It just made sense after we kind of briefed it and war-gamed it. And the Rangers wanted a fire support guy there because we'd have assets overhead. And if they got in trouble, then they'd need somebody to, you know, help them out with that. So it was a successful mission. They got in, did their mission, and we got them out. And they came back and went on the hit to Rhino and Gecko.
Chief, I'll tell you, honestly, my respect for you really spiked hearing this story. I mean, I essentially lay out in my essay that you can grab some person off the street, you can put a static line chute on them and you can stuff them out the door and they'll probably be okay.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe 9 times out of 10, I don't know. They'll probably be okay. If you did that same thing and dumped them out HALO, they probably would not be okay.
No.
Because there's a lot of stuff you have to be able to master.
Yeah, it is.
To live. Anyway, enough said for me.
I asked one of them, I said, now, let me understand this. I said, we're going to tandem? They just looked at it like, oh, no, Chief, we're not going to tandem.
That's what I was thinking, but no.
Okay. I don't know if they were messing with me, but I was going with that recce team. I was going to do a combat HALO jump.
I'm speechless, man.
If I'm not mistaken, SEAL Team 6 did a tandem with a non-qualified support guy in the Captain Phillips operation.
Oh, okay.
Totally plausible, man. I'm sure they did.
Here's what I thought about it. They jump dogs all the time. They're not even qualified.
But it still goes on the dog's record as a jump.
That's right.
Did just the dog get paid for it? Nah.
Nah.
Enough.
It was an exciting time. And Man, I mean, we were just coming up with all kind of stuff. And there's some things that we did that I wish I could talk about, but I can't. And I mean, it was cool. I mean, it was some World War II stuff that we would come up with. And yeah, it's pretty interesting, but it worked. And, you know, we have the greatest minds and the most intelligent human beings on the planet figuring all this stuff out. And
plus the nuts, Chief. I mean,
oh yeah, we're all crazy.
All of these great traits of people, you know, intelligence, this and that. When it comes right down to it, man, it's the nuts of people that are willing to risk their lives to do these kind of things. That's what separates y'all.
It does, Gio. You know, man, you've been there, done that. I'm thankful that, you know, I was with those men and that team. And I mean, I was just like so many times, I was right place, wrong time, wrong place, right time, however you want to look at it.
But yeah, fate, man. What are you going to do? Fate.
Yeah. I mean, Psalm 91 looked over us, and we did a lot more crazy stuff than that over the next few months.
If you're done talking about Gecko and Rhino, when you are done, if you could transition over to Head at the Dam, that's a really sacred subject to me, you know, because I knew the man on the ground
who was
at Hadatha, and I know a bit. I know a lot about what happened. I know very little from his perspective, but
I know the man, so he doesn't say much anyway. So.
Well, he's a grumpy guy, you know.
Yeah.
But him and I are in touch almost daily with a 3-word text like caveman. Yeah. You know? But we are in touch, and he'll talk to me eventually. But I want to already know what the air's perspective was like from you guys. And then I can add that to content from him, and maybe I can put it together into a decent story for the Soft Rep readers.
Yeah, and it's ironic because I don't know if I told you or Stravos, but I'm in the middle of writing that story right now.
That's great.
I just sent some other stuff, but I tell you, man, I think about it every day. It was just by the grace of God that we made it through that thing. And
just another day, Greg.
Yeah, it's another day at the office, another day for a 6-gun. Our team, we're team 4, but I'm going to explain all that in another story. And we had 4 teams of 2 AHs operating. We were lovingly referred to as Team Jackass. We were jackasses. And again, it was like every major gunfight with, you know, the Rangers or Delta, we just happened to be there, or, you know, it was our turn to get into the pipe and we were there. So actually we were planning the Jessica Lynch rescue with 275. 275 had been given the original mission, and man, we were, you know, and poor 275, they've been kind of the bastard kids for several years. And we, of course, they had several friends at 275, and I was like, all right, man, they're going to get in a fight, and this is going to be a big one for them. Well, long story short, we got pulled off, and we got sent up to Hadifa. They says, hey, Greg, you and Mike and the guys, we want you to go up there and support 375. And we're like, well, okay. So we loaded up in a C-17. They flew us up there. And actually, somebody told us it was the first combat offload on a C-17 up to H1 is where it was, and that's about, I don't know, 20, 25 miles west of Haditha Dam. So the operation was 375 conducts an airfield seizure, airborne jump, combat jump into Hotel 1. It was an old airfield out there. It was an old oil and gas pump site. So they conducted the airborne assault, secured the airfield. We landed with our 2 AHs. We got there to the brief. Colonel Bailey was battalion commander at the time. He had broken his back on the jump. So they briefed us up. They says, hey, we're going to Haditha Dam. It's the highest regarded structure in the country because, one, its size. I have never sized it up until now, but I guarantee you that thing was at least a mile wide, this dam.
Damn.
And it was big hydroelectric, you know, big giant lake to the north of it. But anyway, our mission was to seize and hold the dam, and we would get relieved the next day by this armor unit coming through because they wanted to keep that dam safe. They didn't want anybody to, you know, blow it or disrupt anything that was there.
To blow that dam, would that flood Baghdad?
The town of Haditha was just a few clicks to the south of it. I think that's where the Tigris River starts at that dam. You got the Euphrates and the Tigris. I can't remember. Okay. But anyway, so a huge strategic target for this war for Iraq. And the weather was just shit, man. It was overcast, low ceilings. So they couldn't get any fixed wing close air support in there. It was our two AHs. So the Rangers, they had some Delta guys with us, some heavy breachers, and then their snipers, their recce guys, to go and, you know, go through the dam and gain any intel or whatever. I never will forget the S2, our intel guy, briefers. You know, we asked about enemy force, and enemy said, oh, it's minimum, you know, a few guys at best. And we're like, okay, roger that. The Rangers took a FARP in for us with rockets and gas and bullets, so in case we needed it close, and it was relatively close, just a few minute turnaround. God, I never will forget old Mo. He was the fire support NCO for third back. We got ready to take off. They're on the dam and light resistance, and then all of a sudden, every time Mo would key the mic, I could hear gunfire, and every time he would it would get more intense and, you know, incoming gunfire, outgoing gunfire. I mean, we could hear RPGs. We could hear heavy machine guns. And at this point, Mo was screaming over the radio, trying to get in touch with his fire support, the AHs. Well, crap, man. I couldn't talk to him. And I finally went up on the sat freak and I cleared all the nets. Because we worked with each other for years and years and years. You know a guy by his voice and kind of know his current temperament. And man, Mo was just, I mean, the hair stood up on both of our necks. And we're like, gosh, damn, dog, we have got to get there. So I can remember we went north of the lake to come in north to south because Mo's BP, their blocking position was on the west end of the dam. Then they had another BP on the east of the side of the dam. And there were about, I don't know, 108 or 110 Rangers there. And then the Delta guys. I finally got a hold of Mo. And I look at Mike. I was just very angry at the time. And I says, a man on the moon can talk to fucking Houston, Texas in 1968. And I can't talk, you know, 4 miles from my fire support guy. But anyway, we knew where they were and we came over this lake. I mean, we were hauling the mail. We pulled the guts out of those helicopters to get there because our buddies were about to get overrun. We come up over the dam and bumped. I'm going to tell you something. I'd never seen anything like this before in my life, and I hope I never do. But it was literally tracers filled the skies on the south side of that dam. I looked at Mike and he looked at me. We're like, oh man, we're fucked.
And he laughs. Sure.
I saw Mo's strobes, you know, there was like, I think 7 or 8 of them in that BP. And every one of them were firing just as fast as they could. And I looked just beyond them and there was probably a company size element maneuvering on their blocking position. And there were dudes running everywhere. Then we find out later it was Iraqi regimental of Republican Guards, Fedayeen.
Wow, man. A whole bunch of other dudes. Top guns.
Yeah, they said there was between 3,000 and 4,000 enemy forces there. But
come on,
they had been told that the Americans were coming to blow the dam up. So they were, you know, they didn't want to lose they had a big base there in Haditha, and so they didn't want to lose the town, and they didn't know we were coming there to save the dam. So they were attacking to save the dam, save their people downstream.
It's insane, man. It's irony.
So we bumped up. I saw Mo, and we shot. Mo told us this. We shot 12 meters in front of those guys. That's how close the enemy was.
Respect.
We mowed them down like bowling pins, man. And broke right, came back around, and young Ranger on the East BP, he was making a call for fire. He was in distress. And we're like, hold on, brother. I said, I got your location, man. Just mark the target. Just mark the target. Because under stress, you know, we're all taught that standard call for fire. And he was like, hey, you, this is me, fire mission. I was like, yeah. just mark the target. Bless his heart, you know.
Yeah.
I know he was praying. And again, you know, we engaged at least a company size element, probably 20, 30 meters in front of his position. And then the fight was on, man. We made, I think it was, we shot 11 loads that night, both AHs.
And so how much is the load?
We got 4,000 rounds of mini and then 14 rockets. So you can do the math. I mean, it was a plus. Whoever's not flying in the AH, you've got your M4 up and engaging targets of opportunity with their M4. And I swear, George, both Tim bubbles were full of 5.56 brass, and we would drop hand grenades on guys. We started doing that. That's another story. But
oh yeah, I've done that myself. I've done a lot, thrown hand grenades off a little bird, man.
Yeah, we started doing that in Afghanistan. Yeah, we burned up our little FARP that the Rangers had set out. It was, I think, 3 or 4 loads. We had a gal also, but we used it up. I don't know how fast, man, but it was just gun run after gun run. Plus there are wires. Just pull that dam up on Google or just there's pictures of it.
I got it. Yeah, I've got it up. And also, Chief, for you, that's the Euphrates River there. And the 11 loads is 48,000 rounds.
Yeah. It's a bunch. Cool. Plus all the 5.56 and hand grenades that we threw out and shot. And yeah, my chin bubble, when we landed that night, my chin bubble was full of 5.56 brass.
Chief, what's a chin bubble?
The chin bubble, that's where it's down low inside the aircraft where the puddles are. And it's, plexiglass.
Chin bubble, gotchas.
Yeah. So the brass just, you know, it just deflects inside the aircraft. And actually, I was in the left seat and I shot one time, and I couldn't have done this if I'd have tried it a million times, but the piece of brass hit the center console and it ricocheted and it hit Mike in the throat and it went down his inside his body armor and his
t-shirt. Oh no.
And he starts screaming and I'm like, oh my God, are you hit? Are you hit? He goes, no. He says, a piece of brass. And I was like, oh my God.
I can see that in my mind's eye, man.
Oh Lord. It wasn't too funny at the time, but man, I know it burned the heck out of him. And
I'm going to interrupt. I'm going to make sure I get this visual correct because I know what I know about AH pilots. So you guys are flying gun runs and one or the other of you, I don't know, maybe both of you, let me know, are hanging outside the helo shooting an M4 carbine at toads running around on the ground. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That's not badass, on the man.
Controls. Yeah, that's badass.
Yeah, you've got your M4 up, ready to engage. Plus, you're doing your cockpit duties, you know, helping the guy flying with wires or finding the target. Yeah, we found it very, very effective in Afghanistan to, you know, use our rifles to engage targets that are offset, where the guy flying, he's focused on, you know, shooting the target that he's supposed to. And it's just very effective.
I personally have known that you guys are not just pencil whipping, carrying a weapon inside your cockpit. You know, it's like like a weapon check, you know, helmet check. No, I've been on the pods. It was in Africa in 1993. You know, gunning off the pods and running dry on my primary. And I had the pilot.
Oh, pilot will hand you a magazine.
Well, that's what he did. He stuck a magazine out the door. And I looked up and I'm like, this guy's got an M4. He doesn't have an MP5. He's got a badass M4. So I took his magazine and that guy proceeded to hand me 7 more magazines. And I said, this guy's got an arsenal up front. You know, he means business. Yeah. So again,
yeah, we I would always carry 10 magazines. I would have that's probably
more than a basic load, eight, man.
Yeah, eight on my my basic load, one a gun and one in a pocket somewhere. That was the biggest battle of the Iraqi war was Haditha Dam. And it lasted, we wound up being there for 7 days. Yeah, we were like, where's that armored unit that's supposed to have been here 3 days ago?
Oh, classic, Lord. Huh?
Did the carrying of magazines became an SOP after the Black Hawk Down incident? So pilots carrying that high amount of personal loadout.
Yeah, that's a real good point, Stravos. It was back then in 93, most of the crews carried MP5s. After the Battle of Mogadishu and the AARs and the debriefs, they went back to carrying M4s. One, the MP5 didn't offer the range that, you know, we needed to have.
Yeah.
And it was just it was a better weapon system for our operations.
That's a submachine gun. It's not an assault rifle.
No. Well, and their thinking was that, you know, if an aircraft went down, it would be in an urban area in close quarters. So I think they thought the MP5 would be a better weapon system. But after Mogadishu, they found different. So
yeah. And those pilots, I mean, they did their share of hanging out the doors and shooting their MP5s, man.
Absolutely.
They sure did. They laid it down, bro.
Yeah, it's lottie-dottie everybody, man, when there's a gunfight. So.
Yeah, pilots are guilty of no pretense in combat, the Night Stalkers, no. That is.
Nope, none.
They're fighters, man.
Most of us in B Company, it was kind of interesting. We all came from combat arms as enlisted. I mean, we had Rangers, we had Delta guys, SF guys, and infantry guys. And so, yeah, it was just kind of a natural draw for those for us knuckle dragging killers to go fly AHs.
And you were also shot down in Iraq, correct?
Yes, sir. Yeah, 19 March 2004.
Would you mind telling us about the incident?
Yes. Oh, Lord. That was, it was another day at the office, so to speak. But yeah, we had been extremely busy 03, 04. And there was Fallujah, Ramadi, and then Amarillo, which is south of Fallujah. And it was, we call it kind of the Devil's Triangle simply because there had been, I believe it had been 7 helicopters shot down in that triangle. So, I mean, Chinooks and 58s and Blackhawks, and it was just a bad, bad place. We'd been in Fallujah hitting targets, and of course we got intel off of one that led to another that led to another. And then on the night of the 18th, we were with B Squadron. They got intel that a high value target we were looking for was going to be there at 10 o'clock that next morning. And we all just kind of sunk. We were like, oh God, daytime. No,
I hear you.
Bad things happen to Night Stalkers during the day. Quite frankly, up to this point, I mean, the whole task force, we've been extremely successful from 01 up until now. You know, I think we were the immortals, you know, I mean, after Haditha Dam and some of the other large battles that we've been in, and crap, we'd come out unscathed. And most of the guys, we'd lost a few guys, but not many. So we came back. Came off that target. Sergeant Major says, hey, we had a little east of Fallujah. Says, hey, you guys go hang out there, crank up, get up on the radio. If we need you, we'll call you. We were like, whew, okay. Because March 04, man, Fallujah was wild, wild west, dude.
Yeah, it sure was.
Area. So we cranked, sat there. Those guys hit the target. They got the guy off, brought him back. Well, there's another high-value target we were looking for down by Amarillo. So they said, all right, we're going to drive down there, go kill that guy, and then we're going to go back to Baghdad. He said, I want you guys to go back to Baghdad there at Biop, you know, get some rest, recock. We're like, yep, roger that. So they went, they headed south, they drove down, they had 5 vehicles, they had 3 gun trucks and 2 Panders. So we got back and I think I was in the talkit or just walked in or something, and they said, hey, those guys are in trouble. They called a tick. troops in contact. So we hauled ass, jumped in the aircraft, flew back there. It was only, I don't know, about an 8 or 10 minute flight, and got on station. And I can remember seeing the vehicles were all lined up. We were getting ready to exfil, and commander came up on the net and says, "Hey, exfil in 1 minute." And then I'd flown down real low to the guys, probably, I don't know, 8 or 10 feet, like we always do, and just, you know, kind of give the international wave sign to them. And
flip them the bird.
Like, right, looks like a middle finger.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's comforting to the guys on the ground.
Yeah. And I mean, from like the whole flight, the hair just, it was just standing up on the back of my neck. And
right.
And P guy was, he was my co-pilot. He was a brand new guy. And I told him, I said, "Hey, bro," I said, "you get that rifle up and you see anything, you smack it." He's like, "Roger that." I'd done a swoop down on the guys, and I was climbing right-hand turn about, I don't know, about 160, 165 feet. I was headed kind of southwest. Man, I heard this giant explosion and this fireball was right by my face. The aircraft kind of shuddered. Then it got real quiet.
Oh, no.
I was like, holy cow. Yeah. So I never will forget. I was talking to, again, my old buddy Jim Hosey. He was there in country at the time. When I got back, he says, "Yeah," he said, "I think the best saying of any deployment ever said was by you when you said, 'You know you're fucked when you get passed by your own fireball.'"
Oh, man. Oh, no. So,
yeah. So I entered an auto rotation, and then I'm an instructor pilot, so thank God I'd done many, many. And I can remember in the physiological part of the body and then your brain, and but every nanosecond was like frame by frame is the best way I can explain it. It's like looking at a negative, George. You're a photographer.
Yes,
you
sir.
Know, you see picture by picture, and that's what my brain was doing at that point in time. As I
good description,
thought back and looked back, and I understand, you know, what happens physiologically to our bodies under stress and different heart rates. And man, I guarantee you, I was way up there. But I got to get this helicopter. Please stay together, because I didn't know what had hit us. Something wound up being an SA-16. That's a shoulder fired. It's very technologically advanced weapon system for that part of the country. And they didn't even know they had SA-16s in country. But anyway, it worked as advertised. And that, you know, that big sky little bullet theory, well, it's bullshit. I can prove that. Again, it was daytime. It was about 1,300 hours local. But I remember checking the rotor. The rotor's very critical in auto rotation. You don't want it to get too high because it could spin off the aircraft. And I'm thinking about keeping the aircraft in trim. And it's just this flat dirt, you know, desert out there. So it's very difficult to judge distance above the ground, you know, or long range distance. So I was relying solely on my radar altimeter. And I kept scanning it and the rotor and just all kind of things and thinking to myself, I wish the engine out audio would stop blaring at me because I know the engine's out. And
yeah.
This extra input to my
brain. Annoying. Right? Yeah.
I was kind of busy. I continued my auto rotation. I decelled at about 65 feet and it was a very aggressive deceleration because I wanted to minimize my ground run. I wanted to bleed that airspeed off. And then at about 20 feet, I leveled the aircraft and I pulled the collective. I pulled, it's called cushion. I just pulled everything I had left. I remember checking the rotor. It was good. My trim was good. I was heading in a straight line. And there's just a lot of things that you got to do correctly to land that aircraft safely. I touched down and it was funny later. P guy and I were talking about it, and in our heads, we were high fiving each other because he was like, "Dude, I didn't even feel the touchdown."
Really?
Yeah, my wingman says, "Man, it was the prettiest auto he had ever seen." I said, well, like Neil Armstrong, I only had to do it once.
That's classic, man.
Yeah, he had one shot to land a limb on the moon.
Yeah, you know.
So we touched down, and I was like, holy cow, man. Okay, this is not too bad. Well, old Mr. Murphy, everybody's familiar with him. So we slid, and it just the cockpit just filled with that dirt and dust and stuff, and you couldn't see. And I, the last thing I remember was, of course, I'm an old cowboy and used to ride, you know, used to buck out horses and train them and stuff. And they go, you know, when they buck, they go to their front feet. Well, you got to set way, you know, how you set way back.
Yeah.
Going forward. Well, I remember doing that, but the helicopter had slid. The skid stuck in some soft dirt, and that started us our end-over-end tumble. And I remember hearing the rotor blades hit the ground. It was, again, it's just, this is all in slow motion, man. It was just, it's incredible what your brain will do. Yeah, and that's the last thing I remember is hearing those rotor blades just popping, you know, popping the ground.
Slapping the ground, huh, Chief?
Yep. And then, you know, leaning back in the stirrups.
That's funny.
Yeah. And I came to, and again, it was cockpits filled with dirt and dust. And I just opened my eyes, and I think I'd been knocked out. I can neither confirm or deny that, because if an aviator loses consciousness, you're grounded for 2 years.
Anyway, right. I know the story.
Yeah. But I kept thinking about, I kept hearing this popping, you know, and I was like, the first thing I thought of is crazy, but it was popcorn, because it was just pop, 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 pop. And then I'm like, holy crap, that's the ammo cooking off. You know, I had a bunch of minigun ammo on, of course, 17-pound rockets, and we were on fire. I mean, I could smell it, and I could hear it. You know, you do the old check, you know, wiggle your toes, move your feet. Okay, I can move my left leg, move my right leg. Then I realize I'm inverted. I'm upside down. Oh, my eyes.
When it rains, it pours, huh, Chief?
Yeah. You know, and I remember I tried to move my right arm, my left arm. My shoulders had been dislocated.
Both of them, right.
Yeah. But I guess I'd rolled on the right. You know, I was in the right seat when I was laying on the ground when it came to rest. So I guess it popped it out. So I just kind of blinked my eyes a few times, you know, and I was like, crap the bed, Fred. You know, and I said a quick little prayer. I just said, God, just, you know, give me speed and accuracy and watch over my girls, man, because if I don't make it out of this, it's all good. I know where I'm going. So my rifle, I looked at it, because that's the first thing, you know, again, as a soldier and a warrior, you know, where's my weapons? Because my aircraft's kind of on fire right now. Well, and then I heard gunfire, you know, as my brain kind of recaged as to what was going on around in my environment. I could hear the 50, I could hear the 240s, I could hear my wingman shooting miniguns, and I was like, okay. So I look over at P-Guy, of course, we're hanging there, and he's kind of up in the air because we were right side low, inverted.
Oh.
Put my hand on his shoulder, and I says, hey, man, I said, you okay? And he kept looking straight ahead, and he kind of nodded his head. But I could see blood all over his face, and I was like, oh, crap, man. You know, I didn't know if he'd been hit or – then the next thing I thought was the old Little Bird cyclic kiss. They're famous for the shoulder harnesses not locking in a crash sequence. I can name several guys right now that don't have any front teeth because they smacked the cyclic in that forward momentum.
Damn, how can that be acceptable, man?
Well, yeah. Luckily ours worked. And so I told him, I says, look, I said, get your rifle. I crawled out of the front. I took my helmet off. And I, in the crash sequence, I'd hit the door frame with my head.
And yeah.
It had cracked my helmet. I didn't know it.
Yeah, you went out.
Yeah.
You went out, bro. Okay.
But later on, I remember telling the crew chiefs to lose that helmet. They'd send it to Fort Rucker, and Fort Rucker would analyze it and say, well, God, this guy took a 10G shot to the head, you know, or whatever. And
so grounded.
Yeah, the helmet disappeared. And
that's unfortunate, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, looking back, I'd kind of like to have had it right now. But
didn't you crack vertebrae in that crash as well?
Yeah, I cracked one in C3 and then two in my L spine.
Yeah. And, okay.
But so I crawled out. Again, my brain shifted to, you know, security of the aircraft, security of my crew, just figure out what the heck's going on. And there was a gunfight was raging, you know, down there. We're about 300 meters west of the building, and the guys were just northeast of us. And I'm like, well, okay. So, but I tried to stand up and take a step, and I'd fall down. I'd stand up, take a step, and I'd fall down. I did that like three or four times, and I was like, crap, man, my leg's broke, you know? So I just sat down, and my wingman later says, yeah, we were watching you. And he said, I was fixing to land. He says, Greg, that helicopter was fully engulfed in fire. We didn't see any movement. And I had to go do a call for fire. So I went and engaged some targets, and I came back around. We were going to land and get you guys out. He said, I honestly thought y'all were dead. But he was watching me, and he says, you know, it was kind of funny at the time. He says, you kind of look like a circus clown. You know, he's up, he's down. He's up, he's down. He's up, he's down.
Hey, Chief, go ahead. A quick question. Isn't it true that despite the carnage on the ground, that your wingman flew over and flipped you a bird?
Yeah, yeah, that's
nice. That's nice. Sorry you wrecked. They
came in. Yeah, they came in and they swooped us. And Jay, you know, he gave us the old American signal, and I gave him one back. That way they knew we were okay. And
just a comms check, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's it, man. No comms. There's no comms good check. Stuff.
No comms and, check.
So he went back around, got back in the fight. So I did a 360 degree security check around the aircraft, and I was like, holy crap, man, this thing is burning. So I thought about my ruck. We all carry our little rucks right behind the seats, and in the ruck we have our night vision goggles, water, ammo, and grenades. Kind of limped over to the cargo bay there. It was just fully engulfed in fire, and I was like, man, I'm not reaching my hand in there, so, you know, screw that. And then I'm like, where's P-Guy? So I crawled to the front of the aircraft, and he's just looking straight ahead again, you know. And I asked him later, I says, what in the world were you doing? He goes, man, I was listening to the radio. They were talking about us, you know, man, there's an AH down, you know, launch the force. Gravy's down. So, and I was like, God, you knucklehead. So I said, all right. I said, get out. I'm not kidding. The aircraft's on fire, man. Again, my focus went to the east because all I could think of was Black Hawk down, you know, little black helicopter shot down right here by the bad guys, and they're coming. I spent a few seconds, you know, just kind of watching again. And then I looked back and I didn't see P-Guy. And by now the flames were in the cockpit. So I ran over there the best I could, and I crawled in, and I just reached up and I pulled his latch, you know, little latches on those seat belts. It was kind of funny because he went down, you know, and fell down on his head. And then he kind of looked at me, and I was like, come on. And I just grabbed him. And I mean, the fire, I never will forget, the fire was just rolling around his arm. It was just weird, man. I grabbed him and I just jerked him out of the helicopter, man, out on top of me. So we got out. We went probably about 50 meters at the 3 o'clock position, because then I got to worrying about those 17-pound rockets. I was like, man, I don't know what those things are going to do, because everything was burning. And, you know, they never did anything. They just burn up. They didn't explode.
The motors didn't ignite, huh?
No, they didn't ignite, surprisingly.
Yeah.
So, I put P-Guy in a prone position. I said, hey, man, I said, I got his helmet off, kind of checked him, you know, like we always do. And he had blood all over his face. And I says, hey, I said, let me see your grinners. Opened his mouth. I looked at his teeth. And I said, okay, good. He didn't smack the cyclic, because that's what I thought. I said, stick your tongue out. And he stuck his tongue out, and he had bit halfway through his tongue. And I'm like, oh, dude. I said, okay. So I told him, I said, look, you watch north. And we were both shaking up. I said, I'm going to watch to the east. I said, if you see something, sing out. Let's put kind of messed up right now. So let's put two sets of eyes on it. Let's talk about it before we engage. And he's like, okay, you know, I got it. So it wasn't, but I don't know how long, but I heard a vehicle. I says, hey, I got contact, my 12. He got kind of scooted around, so he had both guns up and at the low ready. And then I heard it stop. Then I looked and see a head bobbing. We were in a little bit of a defilade there. Then I could see I saw his eyes and sunglasses, and I saw a beard, and I was like, oh, I know him. I said, okay, we're good. Lower your weapon. And so Chaz he kind of stopped, and then he just took off running towards us and got up there to us and put his arms around us. And he's like, man, I sure am happy to see you guys. He said, we thought you guys were dead. I said, no, we ain't dead. So, yeah, the rest is history. We had about a 6-hour gunfight after that and got trucks stuck and got them out. And, oh, Lord, we had to drive out of there because combat search and rescue, Air Force special ops guys refused to come get us. Said it was too risky. The troop commander wasn't too happy about that, but yeah. He's like, hey, we'll take them out with us. But they're over in Ramadi, so we fought our way out of it. Well, we went in the town into the bill there because I wanted to see if we could find any evidence. Two of the guys saw the missile shot, and it was on top of a two-story building. We assaulted into there, and oh, I remember this. It was kind of cool. We are, these five vehicles online. We're just racing across the desert. I'm in the back right seat behind Sergeant Major. And I look out the window, and I look right, and then I look left, and I was like, all I could think of was Rat Patrol. Remember that old TV show?
Hell yeah.
Those British dudes.
The Rat Patrol. Heck yeah.
The Rat Patrol, because we were, you know, hopping over little bumps, just hauling ass, you know. All guns were going off, and the gunners were engaging targets. And anyway, that was a short combat pause, I guess. And then we got stuck. Then we got out under fire. Then we made it into the ville, and I went with the Sergeant Major. He went and had some, shall we say, conversations with a few of the people there. You right know on. Who I'm talking about, G.O.
Yeah, I absolutely do.
Yeah, and he's like, come on, Greg. I was like, so they cleared the building where the missile shot came from, got up there, and couldn't find anything. And we got back, and then some more dudes started to engage us. And Jeremy Smith, he was a young Ranger.
Oh,
he was Ranger Smith, a top yeah. gunner. He started shooting up some tents and buildings, and I saw this dude ran out on the roof in a black man dress with a cell phone, and I was like, okay, he's calling his buddies. So I engaged him, and then Jeremy engaged the building, and then a couple of dudes came running out of a building with one carrying an RPG and an AK, so we engaged them and fought our way out of there, fought our way through Fallujah, between Fallujah to Ramadi, through Ramadi, and then finally to the MSS about 9 o'clock that night when we got there.
Going after the guys that shot you down, described you as like the master counterpuncher. We'd like to ask you one last question that we feel is pretty important. We know you're a philanthropist, and we know you're giving back to the community, and we'd really like the listeners to hear about what you're doing, because we know you're not ever going to toot your own horn, so we're going to toot it for you.
I'm just a man. God's got a purpose for me, and I got real involved with working with other veterans and helping guys out, especially the younger guys from the community. A lot of Rangers, few of the Delta guys, and it's just to minister to them and mentor them and help them through their problems and their issues. And I'm pretty involved in a couple of the better known nonprofits. One we got here in Young County, Texas. It's Young County Warrior Ranch, and we have a real nice facility here. We got a building that sleeps about 20 guys, and we do a Hilo hog hunt every yep. year in March. Yeah, yep. If you guys can ever get down here, we'd love to have you. But good friend of mine, a icon in the Ranger Regiment, Special Operations Communities, Sergeant Major James Pippin. And he lives here in Graham. But yeah, we put that thing on, and it's just, man, it's just medicine for these guys. We have, generally we'll have some active duty Rangers come in, then guys from all over the country. And we do another big helicopter hog hunt in Ennis, Texas in February. And, you know, again, it's these, you know, these younger guys come in, man, and they're angry and they're grumpy. And man, after they leave, they're happy. And, you know, they get to be with guys of their own breed. And, you know, they know that there's guys that have been there and done that, same as them.
I'm going to throw this in there because I think it's pretty important. And Stavros, the way I met Chief, you know, I didn't meet Chief in the service at all. I had no idea who he was. But I had a pretty dark year in Las Vegas. And my oldest daughter came and she brought me to Albuquerque to take me. And I was just not recovering, you know, I wasn't getting better and it was just getting worse. And I got a phone call one day and it was, the man said, my name is Greg Coker. You know, I'm a former Night Stalker and I heard you're not doing well. And me and some of the guys, we're going to make a road trip out there and come get you, take care of you. That's how I met Chief. So
that's really nice of you, Craig.
Yeah, that's what we do, man. The war doesn't end. You know, there's a saying in the Ranger Creed, never shall I leave a fallen comrade. And that's forever, man. It's just like the oath that we all took. It's forever. Yeah, when brothers are in trouble or in need, we rally the troops and we go get them. And
they don't just say that.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, George and I both, we've lost some very, very good friends to suicide. And, you know, they lose hope. And they don't have a loving God. Yeah, they go to another place. So I'm very, very, I'm on a crusade, so to speak. I mean, I've been crusading my whole life. Did it in the Mideast for 8 years, regardless of what people think or say. You know, the crusades will continue for a long, long time. But yeah, I love each and every one of them. And, you know, I want them to know that.
Much love, Chief.
Good stuff. Good stuff.
Yes, sir.
That's the point, after all. Having your buddies back to take care of your own.
That's God's purpose for me and many of us out there. So, yeah, we got to stay in the fight. We got to stay in the fight.
Guys preach that a lot. A lot of guys preach that. You know, I got your back. I'm there for you. Everybody wants to help till it's time to help. But yeah. Chief is a doer, man. He's not a sayer. He's a doer. Well, so,
thanks, George.
No, man, I'm indebted to you for my life. That's for sure.
Well, we all depend on each other.
Craig, thanks again for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Chief.
I was very reluctant to write and to start. And
yeah, you know, true.
George has been a huge proponent. Kyle Lamb, of course, my wife, Edie.
Roger, Kyle Lamb.
I think it's important for the next generation of warriors that come up to hear these stories. And you know, and it's not about me, it's about the team. It's about all of us. We owe our successes to each other, and we couldn't have done what we've done without each other. That's the message, I guess, my end state.
And you can check out the podcast and Greg's at our new site, which just relaunched SoftRep, where you can find a thriving community of active duty and veterans and people affiliated with the military. Yeah, that's it. On time, on target.
Every time, plus or minus 30 seconds. Thanks, Stavros.
Don't even mention it. Thank you.
Thank you, Gio.
Cheers, Greg.
All right, out here.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter @SoftRep Radio.